Hello and welcome to Radio Entrepreneurs. My name is Alex Cooper. We're sitting in today with our special full featured episode on cannabis and cannabis business and being a cannabis entrepreneur in Massachusetts. Have my guest host with me today is Walter Sullivan, my resident expert on cannabis from the law firm of Freddie Flaherty. And we're with Michael Dundas of Seri Naturals or Seri Naturals.
Seri Naturals.
Seri's on my phone. Sorry That's about right. that. So tell us how you got started in this business.
Gosh, that's a great question. It started almost 5 years ago at this point. I hadn't participated in the cannabis space before this, but had kept an eye on the space as it was developing in other states. I'm originally from Massachusetts, had lived on the West Coast in California for a number of years, and saw the development of medical cannabis out there. When I had heard that it was on the ballot back in November of 2012 here in Massachusetts to be legalized for medical purposes, I took a long look at the space and the potential and decided to throw my hat into the ring for one of these licenses, and that's really where it all began.
Michael, you really are a true success story, and I mean, I'd argue on the way you came about. You were in the first round. Can you explain your process of going through the round? You're looking for investors, finding locations.
I think the one of the biggest challenges in operating in the cannabis space in Massachusetts and acquiring these licenses was exactly that, finding the locations. Finding a location involved a multi-step process with really sort of a multi-tiered screening process for municipalities. Not only did you have to have the right property, the right landlord, someone who'd be willing to take a risk with you on a sort of legally ambiguous business at that time, and still somewhat today. But you also had to find the right community. The town legislative body had to have put some kind of zoning in place for this, otherwise it was a huge risk that they would do so subsequently and perhaps zone you out of existence. You also had to find a community that was willing to accept you on a sort of cultural level. There's a lot of folks out there, a lot of misinformation or bad information about cannabis, medical cannabis. Certainly nowadays we're seeing quite a bit of pushback on the adult use cannabis side from local community members who simply say, look, I voted for it, I'm in favor of it, but not in my backyard. And so you want to be able to see if you can get some comfort on that level, that you have engaged your community sufficiently so that you feel comfortable moving forward. And then, of course, you have to find capital. These are very capital-intensive businesses to start, in the sense that, at least on the medical side, we are all required to be vertically integrated, which means we have to essentially operate three businesses in one: a cannabis cultivation business, which is a large agricultural business; a products manufacturing business, where you take those plants and you turn them into a variety of different products, what we call marijuana-infused products, or MIPs, MIPs. And then, of course, a retail business. All of those three segments have to be housed in the same corporate entity under the medical cannabis rules.
Now, originally, the law required you to be a nonprofit. They finally changed it to make it a for-profit. How difficult was that in order to raise funds?
Walter, it was extraordinarily difficult to raise funds as a nonprofit. And it wasn't just as a nonprofit. I mean, I don't get too deep into the technicalities here, but you've got to remember that the nonprofit requirement was imposed by the medical marijuana ballot initiative. The ballot initiative simply said these organizations have to be nonprofits. But when you think about it, what does a nonprofit really mean? In the context of medical cannabis, it simply meant we had to be incorporated under the Massachusetts nonprofit statute we call Chapter 180. However, most nonprofits in the popular sense are tax-exempt charitable organizations. And what defines a tax-exempt charitable organization is their status under the IRS tax code, a 501c something, usually 501c3. Mm-hmm. Of course, cannabis companies are precluded from getting that IRS tax status. So we are not tax-exempt. None of us are 501c3s. We're simply a nonprofit under Massachusetts law. So that creates a very sort of sketchy dynamic when we're trying to get out there and raise funds. We can't take funds from a normal, through the normal donation channels that a typical nonprofit would take them. And we're not tax exempt. And yet we're required to adhere to analogous rules that the IRS uses in scrutinizing tax-exempt organizations, which means no private enormity. If you've got quote-unquote investors, they can't take out those share of those profits pro rata to their investment. All of our, quote, profits must go back to our charitable purpose. like any nonprofit. And then, of course, you don't find too many nonprofits out there in the true nonprofit community. Not that we're not nonprofits, not that we're not true nonprofits, we are. But in the typical nonprofit community, you don't find too many organizations that are essentially manufacturers and retailers of products. That's just not the classification that a manufacturer retailer would generally take. So all of those things combined together makes it a very difficult environment for raising capital.
Now, if you're going to advise an applicant looking to get in this business and also looking for investors, how would you tell them to approach an investor?
Well, the first thing I think we have to note is, as you've mentioned, the environment has changed. So we're no longer required to form as Chapter 180 nonprofits. Those of us that had originally formed as Chapter 180s are now going through the process of what they call conversion into a typical business entity. If you start off as a typical business entity, which many of the new applicants will, and certainly all of the applicants under the adult use cannabis statute will be applying as typical business entities, then you would use the normal channels. Now, the normal channels are still fraught with risk for cannabis businesses simply because of the federal unlawful or gray area nature of cannabis, as well as the fact that it's a relatively new industry. I think you could still say, in many ways, it's a brand new industry. And the folks operating in the space typically don't have a lot of business experience, although that's changing now. And so we're seeing more and more sort of serial entrepreneurs and seasoned business executives coming into the space, which is good. But I think that, that federal gray area in terms of the legality and the sort of newness of the industry and the fact that things are changing, the rules are changing under our feet all the time, create a heightened risk environment for investors. I think it's easier now than it ever has been, but it's still more challenging than a typical business would be.
You have a number of applicants that got into business, exactly, you said, that really don't understand how to run a business, and they're out approaching investors. Investors get a little nervous about working for someone who doesn't have a clue. How would you advise them in how to sell that to an investor? Do they have to give up a piece of the business? Or, what are the issues that you see those type of applicants facing?
I think it comes down to the rudiments, again, of starting any business, any entrepreneurial endeavor. You've got to know what your business is. You've got to have a clear vision and a clear mission. And you have to have a clear plan. You need a roadmap. You need to say, look, this is what I want to do. This is how I propose to do it. This is how we're going to get there. And for a lot of these folks, it may mean bringing in folks that have more experience than they do. Again, we're in a brand new industry, and there's a lot of folks that have big dreams and stars in their eyes about money growing on trees. I can tell you from experience, it's a very, very difficult business to engage. Again, the regulations are constantly changing. The business environment is constantly changing. You're trying to begin a business that really has no track record, no history. There's no historical data to look upon. So, I mean, one example is we're at CIRA today, we're trying to implement a comprehensive enterprise resource planning platform so we can take a look at see where we are, measure our results, and predict planning for the future. It's very difficult to do that in an environment where we have zero industry experience. There's no data, there's no historical data to look on, very, very little historical data to look on in order to base our benchmarks. So we're essentially installing this system and then just watching ourselves from day one. There are probably many, many other examples of ways that the fact that this is a brand new industry makes it a little more difficult for investors to wrap their minds around. And so I think that entrepreneurs would be well advised to be open-minded when they go to the investment community, and yes, perhaps have to give up a little bit more control than they might want to as a typical entrepreneur.
What do you see as right now, obviously it's a new industry, but do you see any ways of suppliers being competitively differentiated from each other in this marketplace? I mean, right now, I guess it's location. If you have a location, you got some advantage, but going forward, is there going to be competition in towns and things like that?
We're certainly seeing competitive pressures already. As every new dispensary opens, we see those competitive pressures really boots on the ground. However, I think that to some extent is a function of the relatively small size of the marketplace today. The marketplace today in the medical side is restricted or constricted by how patients or our customers are able to enter that marketplace and become customers. So today in Massachusetts, there's about 46,000-48,000 registered medical marijuana patients. That's the total pool of marketplace participants for us. We can't take folks in off the street. You have to go to the doctor, get a certification for medical marijuana, and then go register yourself with the Department of Public Health in order to come to one of our facilities. That's going to change with the adult use marketplace. And that marketplace, it's estimated, will grow anywhere from 15 to 20 times in size overnight. And so that's going to be a game changer in the competitive landscape. But I do think that as the marketplace matures, and I would again reiterate, we're at the very, very beginning and these sort of opening times for this marketplace. As the marketplace matures, there certainly will be competitive pressure. There'll be downward pressure on prices. There'll be pressure on different providers to provide the types of services that are typically provided by competitive retail businesses. And at the end of the day, that's what this is.
Now, you've been the old saying in real estate, retail real estate space, location, location, location. You have been extremely successful in your locations. You have Cambridge and Somerville, and you're going to have Needham coming online relatively soon. Can you explain the processes you went through? Let's deal with Cambridge first. In your location, they originally only had two zones, and what you accomplished to get that third zone created.
Yes, I think you're right that location matters a tremendous amount, especially moving forward into the adult use space. Location matters much more than it used to. Cambridge was a marketplace that we were always very interested in, perhaps for obvious reasons, obvious population density reasons, but it's also just a great community. We've loved the community of Cambridge for a long time. I grew up in the town of Newton, a couple towns over from Cambridge, very familiar with the Cambridge area. And when we had first approached Cambridge and looked, as you say, they had two medical marijuana zones. And Cambridge had done, interestingly, what most other communities had done at that time for medical marijuana, which was zone it to the outskirts of town, put it in sort of the industrial areas, out of sight, away from places where it would be seen. I think it was still seen by many communities as sort of this untoward use, and folks didn't want to have it front and center in their communities. Cambridge, on the other hand, and this is where I say it's sort of interesting and ironic, Cambridge put it in those zones, not for those reasons, but for reasons of accessibility. In the early days of the medical marijuana program, it was envisioned that there would be very few licenses granted by the Department of Public Health. And in fact, there were only 9 licenses statewide granted in that first application round. There was very explicit guidance by DPH that said that these were going to be regional hubs to serve larger communities, not just the cities or towns in which they were situated. And so Cambridge, I think, smartly put these things out. It was in the extremities of the city, but they were sort of by major thoroughfares or regional hubs. So out in the Alewife area by Route 2, that interchange out by Fresh Pond, and then in the North Point area out by the expressway, where the expressway comes into Cambridge. And the problem, though, was that there were really no viable properties in either of those two zones. Most of the zones were taken up by commercial tenants that didn't want to rent or lease to cannabis companies for legal or other reasons. And there were very, very few actionable properties. And so we decided to go back to the city of Cambridge and we said, look, there's no space in these zones for cannabis. You had the right intentions when you zoned it, but the problem is it's essentially zoned out of existence. So how about we work together to craft a zone that makes sense for providing this medicine for patients in Cambridge? And I'm gratified to say that they were amenable to that type of message. It took a long time, a lot of meetings, a lot of community meetings, neighborhood meetings, meetings with the city council, the community development department, at the police department, local public health officials, but we got the job done.
That's sounds like quite a challenge.
It was tough.
Yeah.
Now you have two locations that are currently open. Do you want to tell the listeners where you are?
Well, we are proudly operating in the community of Cambridge, as we said, 1001 Massachusetts Avenue. For those who remember, it's the old Orson Welles movie theater. For those of a little bit of a younger generation, it's the old 1001 Plays, the arcade that I used to go to as a kid. It's right in between Harvard and Central Square. So it's a below grade location. It's on the lower level. So it's one of those buildings you walk into the plaza and then you can go down on the
access,
side.
Public transportation.
Sure. The number one bus goes right by the front door. And then you've got Central Square about a half a mile away and Harvard Square on the other side. And then we're operating in Davis Square, 240 Elm Street, just below the B Fresh supermarket. So right there in the heart of Davis Square, on Elm Street. Again, we're on the lower level, but in the Davis Square location, you walk in straight off the street, you'll see our sign.
Right in Davis Square.
Right in the heart of Davis Square. We love Davis Square. Somerville's been great to us as well.
Well, thank you, Michael. Thank you for coming in today. This is Radio Entrepreneurs, and we'll be back after these messages.